ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Sarah, did you know that Jane Austen kept notes of what people thought of her books?
Just the good reviews, I hope.
No, she seemed pretty happy to document the negative comments too. Apparently, her mum told her that Mansfield Park was not as good as Pride and Prejudice, and that she found the character of Fanny Price, that main character, insipid.
I have to say, I think both of those comments are fair.
Oh, ouch, 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 ouch. Well, Jane might write that down too. But today we're celebrating 250 years since the birth of Jane Austen, and I have called in a real expert, not just you and me, to talk about who Jane Austen really was. And to announce her, ding, ding, please welcome Stone Cold Jane Austen to the track.
I'm Devaney Loser. I'm Regents Professor of English at Arizona State University. And I guess I get called a Jane Austen obsessive because most parts of my life are Austen saturated, including my sport, my hobby, roller derby, in which I often have skated as Stone Cold Jane Austen. So a mashup of the professional wrestler and my favorite author. But truly, Jane Austen has saturated every part of my life for a lot of years now.
When did you first fall in love with her?
Well, I think it was around age 13, and it didn't take immediately for me. I wasn't one of these immediately understood that this was my book and my person. My mother put the book in front of me several times. It was Pride and Prejudice that she put in front of me. And I think it was maybe the third time she kind of insistently put it before me that it finally started to seem funny to me. Like, I got the comedy. And once that happened, I was absolutely hooked.
Okay, Devaney, we've called you in as an expert on the life of Jane Austen. Can you start by running us through the vital stats as they were?
Yes. So Jane Austen was born on December 16th, 1775 in Steventon, which is a rural area in Hampshire, England. And she was the daughter of the Reverend George Austen, a clergyman, and Cassandra Lee Austen, who was known for her poems and her wit. So she had two very interesting parents, but they were not by any means a family of great wealth. They were what is sometimes called pseudo-gentry or low-gentry. That means that they were not themselves landowners. Her father had to scramble in some ways to support what became quite a large family of eight children. So she grew up in a very intellectual, I think, environment. But her father was always looking for some other way to add to the family's income. One of the ways he did this, interestingly, was by taking in male pupils. So there were, one scholar has estimated, 19 different boys who spent some years of their lives in this clergyman, Reverend George Austen's home. So in effect, Jane Austen didn't just grow up as a clergyman's daughter. She grew up in a boys' school, which is also just a bizarre way to imagine it, but in some regards true.
When did she start writing stories?
It's believed that she started writing around age 11, which is just a remarkably early age. The writings that survived from this period, she recopied at some stage. And so she cared enough about her tween years or, you know, her childhood writings. Sometimes they're called the juvenilia, her childhood writings. She cared enough about them that she recopied them. So we have access to these works, these earliest works of hers in her handwriting. And they've been published across the course of the 20th century. They didn't used to have a great reputation. They were seen as, you know, not maybe silly or lightweight, but I don't think they have that reputation anymore. I think you can see her brilliance, her genius in these works from 11, 12, 13 years old. It's quite incredible.
And was she writing along the themes that, you know, we know from her novels, marriage, romance, class, all of that sort of stuff?
Some of it, but in a very odd way. That is, she was doing send-ups of the stereotypes of fiction writing in her day. So if you would, you know, normally have a shipwreck and a surprise meeting of a long-lost father and daughter, she would include some of those features in her juvenilia, but it would be completely for comic effect.
There's also a story with cannibal children, right?
Yes. I love this. You don't expect there to be like a little light cannibalism in Jane Austen, but there is. And it's a mother who's been held in a private dungeon. And when she's released, she says she had reason to think her children might be hungry because they'd bitten off a few of her fingers. So yeah, there you go. Little light cannibalism in Jane Austen's teenage writings.
Light cannibalism in Jane Austen. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, it sounds like young Jane was having so much fun and getting so creative.
And some of this early work, it really sounds as though it's not that far away from Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that adaptation that came out in 2009.
You're so right. I remember there was a bit of pearl clutching about that at the time, right? You know, this idea that, oh, Jane Austen would never. But maybe Devaney Losa, a teenage Jane, would have loved it.
I have argued exactly that, so I agree with you. We are on the same wavelength here. The juvenilia is filled with drunkenness, adultery, murder, not the things you necessarily associate with the mature Jane Austen, with the Jane Austen of the six major novels. But once you read the juvenilia, you can see where she's coming from, and you can see where the comedy transformed, but includes some of these same elements that are riffing and making fun.
We're celebrating Jane Austen here on The Book Show, just in time for the 250th anniversary of her birth. I'm Claire Nichols, and over the next few episodes, we're going to explore Jane Austen's work and her legacy. Today, though, Sarah Lestrange, it's all about the life of the woman herself.
And it's just so fascinating to hear about her teenage writing. And while I'm not surprised that she was such a busy kid, I'm really surprised. She wasn't published until, what, the age of 35?
Yeah.
When this was Sense and Sensibility, when it was released.
Well, that wasn't for a lack of trying. Devaney Losa, tell us, how hard had she tried to get published before this?
So we do know some things about her having tried to publish her work in the 1790s. We know that her father, for instance, tried to take a first novel out to a publisher and that it was rejected sight unseen. It was rejected by return of post. So it's not clear if that was Pride and Prejudice or if it was Sense and Sensibility. I think most people believe it was probably, quote unquote, First Impressions, which was the early version of Pride and Prejudice. So we know that she tried and that in between that 1790s attempt and when the Sense and Sensibility was published in 1811, she did sell one novel. She sold a novel in 1803 for £10, and it's the novel that would later become Northanger Abbey. But oddly, the publisher who purchased it did not bring it out, paid £10 for it, and then didn't publish it. And so this has caused scholars a lot of confusion to try to figure out why would a publisher pay an author for it, but then neglect to publish it. But, you know, poor Jane Austen thought she was about to become an author in 1803, and it didn't happen. And it did finally occur in 1811.
And in the end, she went and bought back that Northanger Abbey manuscript, right?
I'm glad you asked about that, Claire, because this is such a delicious story, too. So she wrote a letter to her non-publisher, Crosby, and said, you know, if you're not going to bring this book out, I would like you to return it to me. And she signed herself Mrs. Ashton Dennis, M-A-D. And you can see very clearly on the draft of this letter that she meant for them to see M-A-D, that she was mad. But yes, it ended up that they refused. They said, you know, if you want to pay us the £10, we'd be happy to let you have it back, but you need to refund the money we paid you. But we're not going to publish it. We purchased it and we're not publishing it. But she sent some years later her brother Henry back to Crosby, and he purchased it for £10 and then apparently had the delight of telling them, you just refused to publish a novel by the author of Pride and Prejudice. Oh, yeah. So they got the last laugh there.
Ha ha! Victory for Jane.
I so love that story. And in the end, that first manuscript she sold, Northanger Abbey, I mean, it wasn't published until after Jane Austen's death at the age of 41.
Yeah, that's right. That and Persuasion both published after her death.
So, Claire, I really want to know more about who Jane Austen was. Because what I know is that there's not that much on the public record, which must make it a really big challenge for experts like Devani Losa.
Yeah, there's about 160 letters remaining. The vast majority of her letters, though, were destroyed. We don't know exactly why. So when it comes to painting a picture of who Jane Austen was, often we have to rely on what other people said about her. And actually, her first biographer was her brother after her death.
Yeah, but what about looking at the books themselves? Maybe the stories tell us more about what mattered to Jane Austen.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And yeah, when you think about it, in all six major novels, the good triumph, the bad are punished, our heroines always end up in the arms of the solid, dependable man. So Devani, what do you think these stories tell us about the values of Jane Austen herself?
So this is where, having read hundreds of others that were published near alongside in the same era as hers, I think helps me see them a bit differently. I agree with you about the core and the ethics and the morality that's there. Clearly, she has a sense of what it means to be good. And her characters who do good and behave in ways that are good have better ends. So that is certainly a moral core. But she, I think, goes a little bit light on her villains. And I think she's responding to a very strong, didactic, moralizing tradition in her era that basically kills off the villain, or, you know, sends them away like they're transported, like transportation, 19th century transportation, or execution, right? They die a tragic death because they're bad. She doesn't do that. She really lets her most flawed and villainous characters have a different kind of bad end. Often they're punished by being around other people who are really unpleasant to be around. And I think that too is a kind of morality, but it's not a punishment in the way that we generally think of it from fiction of this period. And you can see too that her heroines are not pictures of perfection. Their flaws are part of what make them interesting and arguably even good.
So we have the public reputation of Jane Austen, which I guess starts with her brother, right? He wrote the first biography of Jane Austen. In that, he calls her quiet, happy, faultless, tranquil. It sounds very lovely. It also sounds a little dull, Devani. Do you believe that this is who Jane Austen was?
I don't. I think that first biographical notice by her brother Henry, which was written months after her death, so perhaps in his defense, it was written in a kind of hagiographic, she was a saint mode, in a moment of grieving. So if we're going to give him a pass, that would be how we'd give him a pass. But yeah, this is silly. This is ridiculous. He says that her life was not a life of event. You know, this is obviously not true. And I think we can also tell from her letters that she was not someone who was boring and nice and faultless. She had a rapier wit and she wasn't afraid to use it, especially in private.
And you say in your new book that she was wild, Devani. What makes Jane Austen wild?
I think this is to counteract the ways we've talked about her as so mild. I think mild is the wrong word to associate with her. I think so much more of what is going on in her writings and her life and her legacy deserves the term wild. And, you know, the subtitle to my book is A Rebellious, Subversive, and Untamed Jane. And I do think that these words go much more along with who she was, how she lived, and how she wrote. I'm not saying there was no mildness involved. Certainly, she was not the wildest person of her day. But there were things that she was doing that were really outside of what was proper. They were outside of what was conventionally feminine.
How wild was it to merely be a female novelist in this period of time?
Well, I think you're right, Claire. I think there is some sense in which we could say anyone who is a woman publishing her works during this period was already crossing a line. You know, the ideal woman was supposed to be passive and quiet and not unlike what Henry Austen describes in his biographical notice of her in 1818. You know, she was supposed to be so modest and never have any of her own ambitions. This is clearly not who Jane Austen was, and it's not really who any woman writer who brings her works to the public eye is. Already saying, I want a public to read this, is inviting a kind of scrutiny and seeing oneself as having something to say. And, ambition is a word that I think has often negative associations with it. But I think Jane Austen was positively ambitious. She knew what she was doing was good, and she wanted readers. She wanted money, too.
Mild is out, Sarah. Wild is in.
I can get behind Wild Jane. But I'm thinking more about what Devaney just said about recognition. I wonder if Jane Austen really did want that recognition because she famously, she didn't put her name on her books in her lifetime.
Yeah, that's right. The author was a lady. Devaney Losa, how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, and so only the first one, Sense and Sensibility, was published by a lady in 1811. After that, very interestingly, and this was common, she was published not as by a lady in Pride and Prejudice, but as by the author of Sense and Sensibility. And each successive novel, she lets you link that novel back to ones that she did before. So in that sense, she wanted to be found, right? She wanted a readership that was going to be able to follow her from one novel to the next. Or maybe her publishers talked her into doing that, right? But I think the sense that the by a lady was the defining moment of her career is a bit overblown. Lots of novelists from this period first published their books without their names on them. But if the book was successful, often what they would do is go back in a later edition and acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Jane Austen had lived if she would have put her name on these books. But I think that's an open question and at least possible.
Because only four had been published before her death, right?
That's right, yes. So
it was still early days.
Very early days. 1811 to her death in 1817, a lot had changed for her during that period. And although she did still have public anonymity in private, and not even that private, she was becoming well-known enough as the author of them that the Prince Regent himself knew who she was. So the Prince Regent was a notorious gossip, among other things, and a patron of the arts. So I think once the Prince Regent knows your identity, I think you can kind of assume that the cat's out of the bag. You know, it's not like they're just a handful of people who know that the author of Pride and Prejudice is Jane Austen. You know, there are probably quite a number of people who do, although I couldn't hazard a guess how many. It's definitely more than a handful.
Okay, you mentioned gossip. I do want to engage in a little bit of Jane Austen gossip, if you'll humour me. I think one of the most famous stories we know about Jane Austen is her engagement for one day. What do you know, Devaney, about this?
Yes. So this is, as you say, a famous story that there was a family friend, a younger man, as it happens. His name was Harris Big Wither. And it seems that the Austen family knew the Big Withers and that Jane and Cassandra knew Harris's sisters. So there was a time when Jane was visiting and Harris proposed to her and she said yes. And 24 hours later, she took back her yes and turned it into a no. So I think one of the reasons this story is so important is because often we want to say, oh, Jane Austen, she didn't have any opportunities to marry. So that when people are saying, look, she must have been somewhat desirable, somebody asked her. So I think this is one reason this story comes in, you know, to prove that she was desirable. That's a little sad, first of all, right? But I think the other thing about the story is that it shows us that she had some reluctance about what marriage meant. And I think it seems likely from what we know of her fiction that she wasn't in love with him. It would have been a good match. She would have had economic comfort. She would have taken herself off of the family balance sheet. So in that sense, it would have been a gift, an economic gift to her father and brothers. She put herself first by taking back her yes. And again, I think we can see at Pride and Prejudice some similarities to the ways Elizabeth Bennet makes her refusals known. Elizabeth Bennet's refusals to me seem much more like Jane Austen's acceptance and then refusal, but that's a speculation too.
This has really changed my thinking on Jane Austen. I love the picture that Devaney has painted of this ambitious, wild woman who put herself and her work first.
Yeah, it's a bit different to that biographical note by her brother, right, about that faultless, tranquil woman. And Sarah, if you want to read more about Jane Austen's wild life, you can check out Devaney's book. It's called Wild for Austen. Devaney Losa, thank you.
Oh, Claire, thank you for shining a light on Jane Austen in this sestercentennial year.
Thank you. And Sarah Lestrange, I'm going to try and use that word sesquicentennial as much as I can in the weeks ahead.
I'm glad you're saying it, not me. And there will be so many more opportunities to do so because we're going to keep this conversation going on Jane Austen, aren't we, Claire? Because next time, the fantastic Colm Tobin will give us some hints on how to read Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. In the meantime, Sarah, I want to leave you with this line from Northanger Abbey. The person, be it gentleman or lady, who has not pleasure in a good novel must be intolerably stupid.
Happy birthday, dear Jane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.